From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Democratic presidential candidates talk of free college, but could there be unintended consequences? We'll get an economist's view. Plus, the one-year anniversary of the Trump travel ban to some majority Muslim countries, families still separated.
The baby hasn't seen her dad yet.
As Detroit welcomes the PGA Tour, does golf welcome every would-be golfer?
I'm usually, when I go to scrambles or when I go to company events, I'm the only one that looks like me.
Freshwater mussels, Mother Nature's water filtration system.
They are filtering for free, and they are actually doing it better than some of the wastewater treatment plants.
And the Michigan roots of the pocket protector.
I think it's just a new source of Michigan pride for us, right? We have Muzak, and now we have pocket protectors.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Tonight is the first of two nights of debate among the Democratic presidential candidates, and it is a sure bet the question of college affordability will come up.
We can make public colleges and universities tuition-free and substantially reduce student debt in this country.
I'm calling for universal free college and the cancellation of student loan debt of up to $50,000 for 42 million Americans.
And all of this comes as 10 public universities in Michigan announced tuition hikes for the upcoming school year. Gary Wolfram is a public policy and economics professor at Hillsdale College. He says these well-meaning proposals could have unintended consequences. Gary, why do you believe tuition-free college is not quite the deal Democrats expect?
Well, there are a number of reasons. First, Jim Buchanan, who won the Nobel Prize a number of years ago, he wrote a book some 50 years ago that pointed out that when you make tuition at colleges and universities less than the true cost of providing the educational services, you get people going there that really should be going somewhere else, that is maybe getting a skilled trade somewhere. So if you look at today, the Associated Builder and Contractor survey showed that there's a shortage of 400,000 contractor jobs. 80% of construction firms have difficulty finding labor. There's a shortage of truck drivers of 50,000. More than 13 million college graduates are working in jobs that don't require a college education. So what we really should be doing is looking at technical training and looking at licensing regulations that preclude people from entering these occupations rather than sending more people into higher education. And I must say, I've been a professor since 1976, so it's not like, I don't think people should be going to college.
Gary, I will say we have certainly heard employers in Michigan talk about the troubles they have filling skilled labor jobs, but they're often the first ones laid off, and wages have been pretty stagnant, and the protection of unions has been weakened considerably. So why would someone who has a choice between college and an apprenticeship choose the latter?
Oh, because coming out of college, first of all, you look and there's $1.5 trillion in student loan debt. Now, why did that get there? That got that high because tuition costs were going up because these government programs have encouraged people to go to college. And in 2005, I did a piece for the Cato Institute saying that what the rise in college tuition that's going to be happening is driven by student loans and Pell Grants and all these other programs that encourage people to go. And if you look at actually who graduates from college, if you look at colleges and universities that have open enrollment, less than a third of their incoming freshmen will graduate within 6 years. So what this program would really be doing is getting people into colleges, and then they're probably not going to graduate, and they will have accumulated this debt, and they would have certainly been better off becoming a plumber or becoming a welder.
You've made a point about if college tuition is being covered by the federal government, what do you predict would happen to tuition if that happens?
Well, certainly it's going to be increasing. I mean, the reason tuition has gone up in the past is because the government is going to pay for it in terms of Pell Grants and the like, mm-hmm. or student loans, and encouraging people to take out loans that they won't be able to pay back. But if they said, okay, let's say they said, okay, University of Michigan, you have to provide free tuition. Well, how's that going to work? Is the university going to be able to charge the federal government for this, or is the federal government going to say, oh no, we're going to pay so much per student? And is it going to say, what does it mean to be a college education? Do you have to offer this class or that class? I mean, if you look at under the Affordable Care Act, there are certain things that you have to offer in an insurance program. So the government would be going on and saying, well, you have to offer this class and this and this class and that. And that's one of the reasons Hillsdale College doesn't take government money or student loans, et cetera, from the government, because it wants to maintain its independence. It's very important that higher education be independent. And this is just driving more reason for the federal government to start telling us, here's what you have to teach.
Gary, what solution do you see that would provide access to higher education for more low-income students who really do want to do this?
Well, Milton Friedman talked about this 50 years ago in what he called human capital contracts. The way it would work is that we could have a consortium of us and say, you know what, we're going to invest in the higher education of low-income people or people in general. And what we'll do is we will pay your way, Gary Wolfram's kid, we're going to pay his way into a college. And in return, what will happen is that we'll get a fraction of his income over the next 10 years or 15 years or whatever. So we could form these agreements. And then what you could see is that you'd end up with consortiums and mutual funds and the like that would, so you could invest in a package of these things where you invest in a package of, let's say, 500 students. And then they would pay back their, pay a certain percentage of their income. But, you know, this idea has been around for 50 years.
But people would still be paying that portion back. How would that differ from student loans?
Oh, because they're paying a fraction of their income, and they don't owe. It's not a loan. It's an equity, and so it's not a debt in the same way that a loan is. It is you're paying back as if you were to buy a stock and you would get certain dividends. It is similar to that. I would just reach an agreement. And what would happen is I would invest in those people if I thought that they were going to pay it back, and encourage people to go that would gain the most from the improvement in their standard of living.
Gary Wolfram, economics and public policy professor at Hillsdale College. Gary, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Today marks the one-year anniversary since the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the travel ban on several Muslim-majority countries. Here with us now is Hassan Jaber, who's president and CEO of Access, Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services. Hassan, not all the countries on the ban list are Arab countries, of course, but what has the impact been of this travel ban on the communities that you serve in Southeast Michigan?
It's been a very, very big impact on the community, especially separation of families. We've seen the number of refugees going down from thousands to less than 150 last year. So it's been a major impact on, especially on the communities in the Detroit area. You hear stories of family separations. You hear stories of reinforcing stereotype against Muslim communities. So it big impact.
Hassan, give us just an example of the kind of story you hear from families or people who've been directly impacted by the ban.
I have one of the employees of Access. She's married to a Yemeni citizen, and they had a child 2 years old. She's been trying for the past 2 years to reunite with her husband. The baby hasn't seen her dad yet. So these are the stories we hear in the community.
What does the process of trying to reconnect with loved ones in these affected countries, when you think of Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Chad, what does that process look like?
You know, it's really extremely hard. And one of the provisions in the Muslim ban is waiver system that's supposed to be on a case-by-case basis. But that waiver system only granted 6% of the applications. So it's been extremely hard to understand the process. And it seems that it's a complete, almost complete shutdown of refugees coming in.
How has this ban, Hassan, made you feel as an American citizen and as a Muslim?
You know, it really is against, it's simply un-American. It's against the values of this country. It's a direct discrimination against religion. It's a direct discrimination against community. It separates people. It's cruel, and it's simply un-American. It's not what this country was founded about.
A year later, do you think we're safer as a country because of this ban?
These false claims of safety, these discriminatory reasons why this ban was introduced are all false. We're not safer because of this ban. In fact, it makes life much more difficult for many, many people.
Hassan Jaber, who's president and CEO of Access, thank you for speaking with us.
Anytime. Thank you.
Who does a better job of filtering water, industry or Mother Nature?
So some of the chemicals that the mussels can take out of the water column are potentially ones that we still have yet to process in our wastewater treatment plant.
Helping Michigan's native freshwater mussels help us. That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This year marks the 100th birthday of Michigan's state parks. So we're going around the state talking to park employees to learn about their park. Today, we head to Crawford County near Grayling to Hartwick Pines State Park. That's where Craig Kasmer is a park interpreter. Craig, what is the story that Hartwick Pines State Park tells?
Many stories, but I think one of the main key factors to this park is we have 49 acres of old-growth white pine forest that remains that was not harvested during the white pine logging era. And so it takes people back to an era where most of northern Michigan was covered with these large white pine forests, and one of the reasons why Michigan became so economically viable during that period in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, 80s, 90s kind of thing. And so people can go kind of step back in time to see what it was like living, if you would have been living here in northern Michigan.
I have to say, I have vivid, vivid memories of my childhood visits to Hartwick Pines. We camped in Michigan a lot, and I remember walking through those pines and also thinking about what it would be like to be a logger. And I'm wondering, how did these 9,700 acres come to belong to the state park system for kids like me to visit?
Well, that's one of the other parts that makes this park so interesting. So originally, it was just over 8,000 acres that was owned by the Salling Hansen Company, which was a logging company in this area that was harvesting. After the white pine logging era took a dive and stopped becoming that, you know, as important as it used to be, the trees were gone. Karen Hartwick was interested in purchasing the land, and so she approached one of the surviving members of the Salling Hansen Company, which was Rasmus Hansen, and Her father, Kieran's father, was Nels Mikkelsen. He was a partner in the Salling Hansen Company, but not in name. And so she knew Rasmus Hansen and Nels Salling. And so she approached him and said, I'd like to buy that property. And he said, okay. So she bought it. She immediately turned it over to the state of Michigan in record time. And so it was supposed to honor her late husband, Edward Hartwick, Major Edward Hartwick, and also to commemorate or remember the importance of the white pine logging era and the lumbermen that were in this area at the time.
Because as I recall from my childhood visits, there is like a logging camp there.
Yes, yes. So there's two museum buildings down there that were built by the Civilian Conservation Corps back in the 30s. And so what we have is we have the actual trees that those lumbermen would have cut down, as well as the story of what it was like for them living in a logging camp at the turn of the last century. They were harvesting here specifically in the 1890s and stopped, frankly, because there was an economic recession felt nationwide. And so they left what was then 85 acres of old growth white pine. They left it there. And 3 years later, when the recession lifted, they had decided to leave that 86 acres. There's 86 acres. We can harvest it. They bought 8,000 acres northwest of that site. And so they started on that instead of cutting down the 86 acres. Otherwise, if they would have continued, we wouldn't really have those trees, right? So kind of interesting how it got saved.
Now, I'm wondering how healthy are these old trees? Is there any danger from pests or disease?
No. The major issues that we have is because they are the tallest things around, towering up to 160 feet. When we get high winds, November and during the winter months, ice that forms on the branches, lightning strikes during the summer, we will lose trees. But that's part of a forest anyway, so you know we can't stop that. But it's not a disease or a pathogen issue. A lot of them are hollow on the inside. They're at the end of their life cycle, so they're not necessarily economically valuable anymore, but they have more of an intrinsic value, I think, than anything else anyway.
What is, Craig Kasmer, as you work at Hartwick Pines State Park, what is your favorite spot there?
Actually, my favorite spot is, there's several, but speaking specifically with the old growth, when you go on a nice fall day when some of the hardwood trees, like the beeches and the maples, are changing color, and it's a nice, warm, sunny day, no insects, you crawl out into the old growth and sit with your back behind one of those large white pines, and you can just feel the serenity. It's very calming. One of the great things about for myself and my colleagues and my staff, if we get stressed by lots of visitors coming in and asking questions, I tell everybody, just go for a walk. Go sit in the old growth for a little bit and calm down, and it works.
Talk about a marvelous battery recharger. As a park interpreter, what is it you do?
So my role is to do all the educational programs. I like to say that when people ask, you know, what do you interpret? I interpret the things that can't speak for themselves. So I talk about the trees and the wildflowers and the insects and the birds and the mammals and et cetera, et cetera. So anything natural resource related, it's my opportunity to express how intriguing and how much we don't know about our natural resources, but and try to get folks to appreciate it. And once you, of course, you appreciate something, you are more apt to take care of it. I will add that we also have a historian here, Hillary Pine, colleague and friend of mine, and she does what I do, but from a cultural and historical sense as well. So our programming is not just natural resource based. We have the historical component as well that talks about the white pine logging era and anything within that 1890s range as well.
Craig Kasmer is a park interpreter for Hartwick Pines State Park in Crawford County, not too far from Grayling. And you realize as you describe your work setting, Craig, we all want to swap jobs with you.
No.
All right. Hey, Craig, thank you for taking time to be with us.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Is there a specific state park you love? Do you have a special memory there or a great story? Please tell us about it. You could submit your pictures and stories about your love of Michigan state parks. Email us just stateside@michiganradio.org or head to our website and look for the question box on the stateside page. Again, michiganradio.org. Freshwater mussels, they are powerful water filters, so they play an important role in keeping the Great Lakes healthy. But some of Michigan's nearly 45 species of freshwater mussels are under threat. Let's find out why as we welcome Dalen Woolnow. She's a research assistant professor at the Central Michigan University Biology Department and Institute for Great Lakes Research. Mussels may look to the untrained eye like kind of lifeless shells, but they're anything but, right?
Absolutely. They are animals. They are in the bottom of our rivers and lakes, and they have lives. There's a variety of different species, especially here in the Great Lakes. We have over 300 species in North America, but 44 here in Michigan. In any one river, we can find 12 different species. So just like you have a cardinal and owls and blue jays, you have that many species of freshwater mussel in the bottom of the river. And those are the native freshwater mussels.
How do they work and what do they do?
So they work like any other animals. There's males and females, sperms and egg. They reproduce. They filter. And the filtering capacity is what allows them to get their food and to eat. But it's also really good for humans to have those freshwater mussels in our rivers across the Great Lakes region because they can filter things out of our water that we might not want in the water column.
And as you just mentioned, we have 44 species of freshwater mussels here in Michigan. How do you tell them apart?
It's a really fun thing. And my students and I at Central, we love telling people about them and showing them because they look different. They might look all the same when you're first looking at them, but some of them are smooth. Some of them have bumps. Some of them have grooves. Some of them have different rays and colors to them. And they grow different sizes as well. So could you even figure out the age of them based on their size or the length of them? Some species, even when they're older, they are smaller as well. Some of them, when they're older, they're bigger. Hmm. So we are just looking at a whole variety of different things in our rivers.
So how bad are things for freshwater mussels in our state and actually in our country?
Things aren't doing very well for the native freshwater mussels. We've seen massive declines in the species across North America, with over 70% decline in the number of species. So many of them are now extinct, no longer found. And within the state of the 44 species that we have, 31 of them are listed as special concern, threatened or endangered by the state of Michigan. And so that's 70% of all of our species of freshwater mussels are not doing well.
Okay, that's a pretty jaw-dropping statistic as we look at our native freshwater mussels. So let's talk about why, starting with the threat from invasive species.
Our native freshwater mussels, especially here in the Great Lakes, were really decimated in the mid-1980s by the new to us invasive zebra mussel. And then the early 1990s, kind of the cousin, the quagga mussel. And both of those invasive species of freshwater mussel came in and literally attach on to hard surfaces. And a lot of the hard surfaces at that time in our Great Lakes were our freshwater mussels. The zebra mussels and quagga mussels attach onto them. They smother them, prevent them from moving around. They prevent them from breathing, and therefore they prevent them or filtering, and they can kill those mussels. And they did.
And they did. I understand, actually, your grad advisor, Gerald Mackey, was the first to discover the zebra and quagga mussels in U.S. freshwater.
Yeah, it was in Lake St. Clair. It was a Canadian side of the Lake St. Clair, but this is bi-national waters as well. And so somebody brought him a zebra mussel to his office and said, "Hey, Jerry, what is this?" And he's like, "Oh my goodness, this is not good."
So starting from Lake St. Clair, what they went on to Erie, and how far are they seen now, these invasive zebra and quagga mussels?
You could look at maps, and it's amazing how predictable it is because they follow the rivers and end up in the lakes. Right now, that invasive front of those zebra mussels and quagga mussels have made it down to Texas. Some have made it across to California. Mm. We have less on the West Coast. We have them throughout the Great Lakes region and a lot of the Mississippi region as well.
And how did these highly unwelcome invasive species get here?
It's likely that they came on ballast tank water. Large tankers would come across from a freshwater area where zebra mussels are native, the Baltic area, through the ocean, and then released the freshwater with these microscopic larvae of the zebra mussels into Lake St. Clair.
Mm. And then besides these invasive species, what are some of the other reasons mussels are threatened?
There's a variety of reasons. Some of it is due to water quality. In the past, it would have been more nutrients, large levels of phosphorus and nitrogen. Now we're getting more of a shift to some of these contaminants that are newer, contaminants of emerging concern, because some of our nutrient problems are actually decreasing in the Great Lakes region, but We do have a variety of other different toxins and chemicals in our water right now affecting the freshwater mussels. Another thing that is preventing freshwater mussels from moving further upstream are fragmentation. So a lot of our dams are preventing the freshwater mussels from moving upstream. And sometimes it's interesting when I say move because they think of those freshwater mussels just sitting there.
But they don't. They move.
They do, especially at their larval stage. Mm. Once the female is fertilized, she releases this really unique microscopic larval stage called glaucidia. I like to say it's like a tiny little Pac-Man that attaches onto the gills of a host fish. Mm. This is a requirement in their life cycle, and then that they hitch a ride on those host fish upstream. And so we're talking about these native freshwater mussels that have been decimated by the zebra mussels, and they are now found often more so in the rivers than the lakes, because the Great Lakes, we don't find them as much anymore, just in tiny refuge areas.
Do you think we'll see more species of mussels become federally endangered?
We have 5 in the state of Michigan right now that are federally endangered, 31 that are state listed. And there are some that we are kind of keeping our eye on. There's a couple of those federally endangered ones that we haven't seen in many, many years and might be considered extirpated from the state of Michigan. So we do see some decline in those native freshwater mussels.
What does that word mean, extirpated?
So extirpated means that it's gone from that one area. So you might be able to find it in another state still, but we haven't seen it in the state of Michigan for a very long time.
So I guess the big question is, what can be done and needs to be done to bring native freshwater mussels out of this danger zone they're in?
The native freshwater mussels, we often do a lot of outreach trying to educate people about these freshwater mussels and that they're actually there so that they're higher on the radar for people making decisions and management decisions. We need to figure out who is where, so what species are in what river. We do this a lot with my students at Central. We go out and do surveys. We scuba dive and snorkel to figure out who is where, how many are there. And then we also have to consider what are the contaminants in the water. One of the neat things that we can do after we figure out all of the problems that might be there and solve those water quality problems, for example, we can develop hatcheries where we actually make freshwater mussels in the lab and in hatcheries to release them, just like we do in our state hatcheries. Or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has some hatcheries as well. So there are some of these mussel hatcheries throughout North America. We don't have any right now in the state of Michigan, but we at Central are working with the Ministry of Natural Resources, the Department of Natural Resources, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to develop one of the first mussel hatcheries in the state of Michigan.
It sounds like since the Great Lakes waters are not very welcoming and they're not very habitable for native freshwater mussels, it seems like would rivers be the hope for the future for them?
Rivers really are, because the zebra mussels, they'll be moving with the flow of the water, and so they end up down in the lakes or behind dams and in those reservoirs. Mm. So the rivers and streams in the state of Michigan, which we have a ton of, are actually really wonderful habitat. And we do have some species that are really unique to this region. We have some of the best reproducing populations of some of our federally endangered species within the state of Michigan.
What would disappearance of mussels mean for our freshwater ecosystem, for our Great Lakes, water system that we cherish?
The interesting thing about the freshwater mussels is how much they can filter. Any one freshwater mussel can live 50, 75, even upwards to 100 years old. And so they are a large biomass of animals that are filtering our water for free. We think about that in my lab as they are filtering for free, and they are actually doing it better than some of the wastewater treatment plants. So some of the chemicals that the mussels can take out of the water column are potentially ones that we still have yet to process in our wastewater treatment plant.
They're ahead of us. I can hear in your voice admiration for these little mussels.
Some of them aren't so little. They can get as big as a dinner plate. So,
okay.
But we really do love them.
What drew you to them?
I think that their unique life cycle, the fact that they use this host fish and they really are keeping our water clean, is really unique. I think there's some love for the fact that we can go to the bottom of the river where not many people consider what's down there, and we can pull up these really fascinating, sometimes really pretty organisms, and we can tell them that they are doing something in the water column that's helpful to humans.
Dalen Woolnough of Central Michigan University and the Institute for Great Lakes Research on dangers faced by native freshwater mussels in Michigan. Thank you so much for talking with us. This was really fascinating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were tugging on your sleeve a few minutes ago for special memories of Michigan state parks, but let's open that up a little bit. We always love hearing from you. Tell us what stories you're focusing on or issues that you want to hear more about, people that we need to tell the state of Michigan about. Let us know. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And always go to MichiganRadio.org and click the link that says Stateside. Still to come, with the predominantly white PGA Tour coming to the predominantly black city of Detroit, it's hard to avoid talking about golf's lack of diversity.
I'm usually, when I go to scrambles or when I go to company events, I'm the only one that looks like me.
We'll talk race and golf after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, and you know what that means. It's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
You know, you have the whole shtick, the, like, dorky pocket protector and...
I have a pocket protector.
That's a nice one. I mean, his was dorky. That's... yours is nice.
The pocket protector, it's an iconic accessory of engineers and a very proud stereotype of nerds and geeks. You see it worn in big major motion pictures, Halloween costumes, and people still use them today. But did you know Hurley Smith, born in Bel Air, Michigan, was the first to patent the pocket protector and make it in Michigan for decades? Here now to tell us about the Michigan roots of the pocket protector is State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. This is kind of a funny one. We're all laughing about this one, Mark. We all know about pocket protectors. Tell us about Hurley Smith and what got him thinking about pocket protectors.
I think it's just a new source of Michigan pride for us, right? We have Muzak and now we have pocket protectors.
There we go. Yeah.
Hurley Smith, as you said, was born in Bel Air, Michigan around 1908. He lived there for a few years, which wasn't untypical. He wasn't able to finish high school for various reasons, so he finished it by correspondence through mail and then saved up enough money during the Depression to attend Queen's College in Kingston, Ontario. And got an engineering degree and then landed at a company in Buffalo, New York that made electrical transformers during the war, beginning of the 40s, late 30s, early 40s. And that's where the concept came up for the pocket protector as he was working for that company.
So exactly what we all associate those who need them and that we'll say nerds or geeks. Well, of course, they had to protect their pockets from all the pens that they would need. So engineers fit right in there.
Yeah, for whatever reason, the uniform of the engineer, as is the stereotype today, is that white short sleeve shirt and dark pants. And the practical application was this is the time of probably more fountain pens and pencils than standard ballpoint pens, so pens leaked.
Yeah.
And especially if you're in engineering, you probably used a rapidograph type pen that leak ink. So this was a practical solution of, hey, I'm wearing a white shirt and I'm tired of having to deal with all these stains in my pocket. So he looked at a way to solve that problem. And as his idea progressed, this is during the time when plastics were just coming about with normal use, and so he used PVC to fabricate the first prototype.
Okay. So had anyone else had this idea, or do we think that Hurley was the first to say, you know what, I've got a cool way to protect my shirt?
There were others that earlier that had similar ideas, but they were never quite the exact use for protecting your pocket.
Okay.
So he was the first in that respect. And then there were many people that claimed it after him, but he filed this patent in 1943, and I believe it was finally granted in 1947.
And I know when he called his invention, he called it an improvement. So he clearly was you know, kind of refining what thoughts people might have had before him.
Yeah, in his patent application, he gave nods to various people that had come close to this concept. His prototype, he literally was using his wife's iron. The account is he used it up in the attic and was creasing the polyvinyl prototypes. And then later, when the early manufacturer, he was using a paper folding machine. I've actually used one of those, so I thought that was pretty neat that he used a paper folding machine to get this two folds in his polyvinyl sleeves.
So Hurley Smith gets this concept, and then what happened? Did it take off? And we see them today, so I guess it did.
Yeah, so he had the concept when he was working for that transformer company, and they actually were recycling some of their transformers and selling them as new, and he didn't think that was a great idea, and called them on it, and so they let him go. So he found himself without a job, and that's when he really said, okay, I have this great idea. I'm going to make a business out of it, and moved to New Hampshire and tried to make a go of it there, and then realized that setting up a business would be more profitable if he came back to Michigan. So he came back to Lansing, actually lived right across the street from where I'm sitting right now.
Wow.
and then set up a factory on Cedar Street and made pocket protectors for decades. They were typically used as promotional pieces, and he did them in multiple colors and figured out how to screen print logos on the front of them. And as I said, others infringed on his patent, but he didn't pursue them for whatever reason. He just didn't think it was worth going after them in court. He always had his quota of orders filled. A lot of them were from the West Coast, which he thought would be a really tough legal battle anyway.
So how long did Hurley's company last?
Yeah, it lasted until the early 2000s. In 2000, he was noted as saying he thought he was the last company making them. So now these are made obviously overseas still. They're promotional items. I came across a recent picture of Bill Nye, the science guy, wearing his official pocket protector. So it's not that they're not in manufacture anywhere, but Hurley Smith isn't making them.
You're right. And I do love, I saw a quote from astronaut Neil Armstrong back in 2000, and this is what he said of himself, and I quote, "I am and ever will be a White Sox pocket protector nerdy engineer." So for that, I guess we can thank Hurley Smith, born in Bel Air, Michigan. State archivist Mark Harvey with the Michigan History Center, thank you for finding yet another really obscure piece of Michigan history.
Thank you.
Well, it is here. The PGA Tour has arrived at the Detroit Golf Club. The Rocket Mortgage Classic marks the first time the PGA is in Detroit. The PGA is working with local nonprofits, including the First Tee of Greater Detroit, while it's in town. The First Tee works to improve access to golf among young people in lower-income communities. Paula Love is executive director of Detroit's chapter of this organization. She says professional golf coming to Detroit helps expose kids in the region to this game.
Literally, you have to drive through neighborhoods to actually get to the Detroit Golf Club. It makes the hope of future opportunities and accessibility possible.
Accessibility to golf is an issue for many young people, and that's according to my next guest. Olajuwon Ajanaku is a former pro golfer and now a volunteer coach with the First Tee of Greater Detroit. Olajuwon, who are, in your view, the most underrepresented groups on a golf course?
The most underrepresented group on a golf course has been, in my opinion, the Black youth, honestly. It's tough to find people that love golf and really want to show the youth that, golf has a lot to offer and golf can really change the way a lot of youth actually perceive life.
And I know that you played golf in college. You went on and played as a pro for a couple years. Now you work in finance, but you are a volunteer coach at the First Tee of Greater Detroit. So with your years of perspective here, what has your experience been as a Black man in a historically rich white sport?
Man, a Black man in a historically rich white sport it's been a journey, honestly. It's tough to find sponsors, if you do want to take it to the pro level. As far as getting into golf, my man, a lot of times it's hard to get into private country clubs. I mean, I used to caddy. I've worked at private country clubs. I've worked at semi-private country clubs. And as far as being accepted, I mean, it's rare. So I'm a member at a country club at the moment. And the first time that a black member was actually accepted into that country club was in the 1990s. And me being 30 years old and actually being the youngest member at the country club, I mean, it's a different experience.
And when you say accepted, what do you mean by that?
If I'm going to be 100% honest, leaving the country club, you meet people for the first time and they say things like, oh, nice to meet you, Jamal. And it's like, nah, unfortunately, my name isn't Jamal. It's Olajuwon. But I mean, it's always a struggle to sometimes find a common ground with certain people. And yeah, it can be a struggle. I mean, yeah.
I can hear it in your voice, Olajuwon, very much. You've got, I can tell you love golf because you light up as you talk about golfing.
Definitely. I love golf.
I ask you the question, is golf a welcoming sport for all? It sounds like it's complicated for you.
It's very complicated. Caring about this, well, the things that people face, well, things that black people face when it comes to golf is how much it costs. You know, there are country clubs that range, you know, $50,000 a year all the way down to $100 a month, you know. So it's all about what's affordable. And when it comes to public golf courses, that can actually be a way in for more people to start playing golf, honestly.
Olajuwon, there are clearly a lot of people excited about the PGA Tour coming to Detroit, even if Tiger isn't going to make it to Detroit. People are
right.
pointing to...
I wish Tiger was
yeah,
here.
Yeah, right. A lot of people do. And people are pointing to the PGA's donations too, and partnerships with groups like the First Tee. What are your own thoughts on the PGA Tour coming to Detroit?
The PGA Tour coming to Detroit, that's, I mean, it's great for Detroit. It's great for the economy. It shows, honestly, it does show black kids that golf is a way that you can venture out and see a whole new world of Detroit, of Michigan, of the United States, period. And also Detroit Golf Club is going to be known as a PGA golf course now. And that's a fantastic thing, because the people that are members at Detroit Golf Club will now have more pull. And I feel as though they'll push Detroit Golf Club and they'll push marketing everything around black golf after this tournament and how popular it really can be.
Are the kids you work with at the First Tee, are they talking at all about what's happening this weekend? What are they saying?
Definitely. The kids that I work with, that I'm teaching, they talk about the PGA tournament all the time. And, they want to see the ball fly far. They want to see long putts made, and they're really excited about seeing it.
Olajuwon, can the PGA be doing more to grow that presence of underrepresented groups in golf?
The PGA definitely can do more. For example, I'm actually on the PGA website, but I'm on there's a program called the PGA 2.0. program, and it's to become a PGA professional, and my face is actually still up there, and that's it's like a few places on the PGA website where you can actually see a black man or a black woman, you know. And if it was more represented, or if the diversity program for the PGA had a chance to sit down with somebody that's been in golf for some time, really attacking the marketing for the diverse group of people when it comes to making golf cool, where it comes to making golf appealing and something that can connect with other ethnicities. As you can see with football, Nike basketball, or Adidas or Puma or just any company, they really target, you know, black people and other ethnicities as
sure.
well.
So these sports trimmings, the branding and the apparel, that really plays into people's perceptions of a sport. And golf
definitely.
Is certainly included.
Definitely is. Golf is definitely included. You know, when I'm volunteering at the First Tee, I mean, you could see it there. There are 30 kids, and, you know, 22 of them are not black, and 8 of them are black, you know? So it's just, as far as like making it more appealing, that's something that the PGA could work on. And that involves, you know, hiring more of a staff where marketing can be, marketing you be towards a different group of people?
You know, just this week, Olajuwon, there was a piece in Crain's Detroit Business by reporter Kurt Nagel talking about a steady decline in interest in golf. You know, Michigan has been a golf mecca traditionally, but courses are closing and participation is declining. And it makes me wonder, is golf truly a sport for everyone to enjoy for years to come, or has the historic exclusivity of this sport, is this causing a slow, inevitable death?
As far as golf being a less popular sport and declining, I will agree. I know when Tiger Woods actually stepped away from the sport for a little bit, there was a decline in watching golf. There was a decline in the excitement. And ever since he's been back, that's been a way that that a lot of black kids and black youth and black people, you know, find golf more interesting. I mean, golf can be as popular as you make it. You know, it can be as positive as you make it. It can frustrate you, but it does have a lot to offer when it comes to the networking piece, when it comes to morals and values, when it comes to actually just being a good person, honestly. So it being less popular and it being a sport that people get into, it just needs to be, you know, more excitement in it, like more gym time, more out on the course, more trick shots, and just different things to get people more interested.
I do have to ask you, Olajuwon, when you had a point that one of the things you feel is if we could make things cheaper. And I'm thinking about basketball. You can pick up a basketball for the cost of the ball, but clearly, right, you know, it costs a lot more to be able to get out there and play golf. Those clubs don't, those clubs aren't cheap.
Right. Clubs are not cheap. This is true. Clubs are not cheap at all. Growing up, I was a part of the First Tee, and the First Tee of Atlanta, First Tee of Eastlake, and the First Tee actually gave me my second set of clubs for free, and they were expensive. Of course, they were First Tee clubs, and they were, older clubs. I used to play with Priscillian drivers, Priscillian woods, and blades, and this blade putter, and, you know, hand-me-down clubs, but it was a great place to start. It was a learning platform, and that's all these kids need. That's all these kids need as far as, you know, push forward, because you're always going to make mistakes, just like on a golf course, just out in life.
A good life lesson.
It's always something you can learn from golf, and you can take that into life. And that's how I feel that it would make golf more popular and honestly make it a sport that black kids can benefit from.
It certainly seems, the barriers of just, obtaining clubs are one thing, but there's no price, there's no cost to creating a sense of welcoming, is there?
Definitely not. I'm usually, when I go to scrambles or when I go to company events or certain tournaments, I'm the only one that looks like me. And to where I'm, decent at golf and I'm scratch, and I do stand out a little bit, and golf could just be more popular. It just really can.
We've been talking with Olajuwon Ajanaku, who's a longtime golfer and a volunteer coach for the First Tee of Greater Detroit. I want to thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on Stateside, this week marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Inn riots, which led to a major shift in the gay rights movement in this country. Tomorrow on Stateside, we'll hear about the history and the future of gay rights in Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.